Hello, Properly Howard fans, because this is the final episode of our Few Good Films season. Steve and I wanted to do something extra special for this podcast. After much discussion, what we decided to do was have Steve's microphone crap out about halfway through this podcast, so you can look forward to that. As is our way, there's no telling how long our delay will be between seasons. We will come back. Who knows when? In the meantime, check out all of the fine work that's happening with the Lorehounds. Never mind the music, Silmarillion stories, Wool Shift Dust, and of course, Severance. We do appreciate iTunes reviews. They will get read on this podcast. You can send emails to cocoonsofhorror@gmail.com. All right, enjoy A Few Good Men.
Well, you'll try.
What am I trying to make?
Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we wrap up our A Few Good Film season with a look at its namesake, A Few Good Men. Starring Tom Cruise, Demi Moore, Jack Nicholson, and a host of Hollywood A-listers, A Few Good Men lifts the veil to expose military cover-ups and its preoccupation with softball rivalries. With me, as always, to discuss this film is Dr. Anthony Ladon.
I was big into softball back in the day. Big into softball. I wouldn't berate my second baseman as much as Tom Cruise does, though.
Oh my goodness, he really. But you know, it's funny. That's his Jessup. That's his code red. Is reserved to the softball. Yeah. That's how he knows he can get Jessup. He's like, hey man, I've been out there. I've been on the diamond. You want me behind first base. You need me.
Steve, we could begin in a lot of places. We could begin with You Can't Handle the Truth. We could begin with Tom Cruise's career. I want to begin with Kevin Bacon.
Okay.
I think he's the coolest guy in this movie. And this movie, I mean, he's like maybe the fourth lead in this movie.
In a movie rife with cool guys, he's the coolest.
Look. There's just something about Kevin Bacon. Every scene he's in, I can't take my eyes off him. But the scene where he's playing basketball and he's like dripping in sweat and he's walking off the court to talk in the hallway with Tom Cruise and Demi Moore. Just watch him walk off the court. He struts. I think that there's never been a better cinematic strutter
than Bacon.
Bacon is the best. There's a lot of things that you could be known for, but the Bacon strut is just magnificent to behold.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if this is maybe the same cinematic universe as Footloose, right? Like so. He's kind of conquered a town. He's danced his way into the heart of a stoic preacher. Enough so, such a good dancer that John Lithgow just kind of forgets the fact that his son died because of dancing. And now he's infiltrating the Marines.
Well, maybe he had to get out of town. Maybe at some point it was like.
Well, he's like quantum leaping into different worlds, I think.
Sure. Yeah.
He's like, I saved this town. I brought dancing back. Now I'm going to bully. See, he knows that Jessup's a problem.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm not here to like a true angel, right? Like he's not going to just come in here and save the day. He's going to use his influence and nudge all of the right players in the right spot. Right. I mean, he even tells, you know, Cruz, straight up, hey, you got bullied into this. I bullied you into it. Like, and he's, even though he's telling him that, he knows he's doing it further. He's just nudging. He's nudging his way into peace. And then now that as soon as he read Jessup his rights,
mm-hmm.
he's off to the next thing. He's off to go be a pedophile in about a dozen movies for some reason.
That's when he falls from grace.
I don't know. I don't know what his end goal was and all that.
At what point was he inspired by Guile from Street Fighter 2? That flat top is perfectly Guile from Street Fighter 2.
Yeah, it's true.
And he's...
Yeah, he's triangular. He's at his most triangular.
All right. What's your relationship with A Few Good Men?
I'm fascinated by it. I think, yeah, I saw it when it first came out. The Nicholson gravitas, right? Like, it's just, I think he pulled us all in. You know, obviously with Batman 89. And like, I feel like I maybe became more aware of Nicholson as an actor later in life.
He was the elder statesman.
Right. And, like, Nicholson was always, like, he was one of those, like, he's a true star. Like, a true Hollywood star. I'm not saying that the other folks aren't, but to the degree where, like, if you'd never seen a Jack Nicholson movie, you still were like, oh, he's the man. Like, he's something else.
Well, and he was one of these guys that if you brought him into the movie for a part like this, it absolutely would elevate everything else going on in the movie.
Right, because he's not really in this movie all that much.
It was the same time when De Niro and Pacino's stars were falling. Mm-hmm. You know, they were sort of not great at being elder statesmen. They were making bad choices. They were turning, like, even the performances that they were being praised for were kind of panned in retrospect.
Yeah, they're like, they almost became self-parody.
A little bit like that. Nicholson did this a little bit later, but at this point in 92, to have him in this movie playing a part that he really had never played before. In his previous career, his younger career, he was kind of like the iconoclast or the guy who's living outside the law or the anarchist or something like that. Now he's the man, right? He's the highest ranking officer in this film. And he's got all the gravitas. Just a thing to behold. Just a thing to behold. And this really increases his star. Like, he was the biggest star in 1992. And he does this movie almost as a, you know, he's clearly a supporting actor. And yet he steals the movie.
Right. I mean, he's very much, like, I'm trying to remember the advertising for this, right? Like, I just don't really recall, like, why, like, obviously it had to be a Nicholson thing, but, like, why did we, like, I mean, you saw this in the theater, right?
It's possible. I don't remember the first time I saw this. I feel like it was always on. It was, like, always on TBS or something.
Oh, gotcha.
I remember watching and rewatching this a lot in college, and a lot of my dorm mates would simply memorize mass, you know, huge monologues from this film. I had a guy down the hall who could just, he could do the whole Jessup. He, like, he memorized every word from Jessup in this film.
See, I did too. I don't know if you remember. So in high school, I would do this. I think it was like senior year.
Like on demand, like people would just pop in a quarter and listen to this.
People would walk up to me and they would say, I want the truth. And I'd have to let them know. And part of it was because I was actually considering auditioning for a play at our school, which I had never done.
Interesting.
And one of the requirements was a monologue. And so I chose that as a monologue.
Oh, so you set out to memorize this. So interesting. So interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, no, this was okay. So for men our age, this was the kind of film that kind of piqued our interest in acting. I mean, for you, you know, literally.
True. Yes, yeah.
It was sort of like some scrawny little kid from Canada who had no investment in, like, U.S. foreign policy or wanted to join the Marines or anything like that would just be enthralled by this anti-hero monologue just because of the musicality of the language. It could be like the best angry monologue in film history. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever it was magic. It was magic to young men who just absolutely wanted a vehicle to express their rage or something. I'm not sure what it was.
Well, rewatching this, and I love that you used the musicality to describe the language, because it is. It's a very sing-song movie. The movie is almost a musical without music. Because the dialogue, in the way that it flows and the way it's delivered, I watching it this other day, I was like, wow. I always attribute the cadence and the rhythm of Nicholson's monologue to, like, specifically that scene. It's throughout the entire movie.
Yeah.
The way that Sorkin constructs these words, and even the way that they're delivered, it all feels rhythmic, and it almost has the same, like, it all feels like it's the same rhythm as his big monologue is actually happening in conversationally throughout the movie. It's really interesting. I didn't watch plays. I wasn't really into musicals. I've watched several musicals, but, like, it feels like you're singing along, I think, to this movie. And it's been several years since I had seen it. So watching it again, I was kind of struck at how many phrases I'll use from this movie. And not necessarily knowing, like, some of them are, like, kind of tropey or cliche, yeah. So they're throughout. But, like, I wonder how much of these phrases that I might use, the origin is from this movie, just because of how compelling and how powerful the language was and how it was delivered.
Yeah, so I was going to save this for later, but I might as well do it now. So I'm probably in the top 500 Sorkin fans in the world. Right. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but if you think of the amount of people in the world, like, that's pretty high. I love Aaron Sorkin. I think he's got a lot of really weird qualities as a person, as a writer. I think he's got a lot of misses, but I feel like I've been on the Sorkin ride from the beginning. Right. So this was sort of this was his play. Even before it hit Broadway, it was already optioned for a movie. He wrote the screenplay, and he's got a lot of Sorkinisms, but one of the things that is pretty common to a lot of Sorkin movies, it's men performing masculinity verbally. That's what he does best. Mm. And you can see it in The West Wing, you can see it in Moneyball, you can see it, you see it in a lot of things that Sorkin does. And if you think about the best context for doing that, the courtroom is pretty good because it's like you win or lose based on your ability to compellingly deliver an argument, right? And then you add on top of that this world of military masculine hierarchy where it's like who's ever got the most stripes on his arm, that guy gets to monologue whenever he wants to, you know? Sort of like, all right, everyone else kind of has to stand around and watch because that guy's got more stripes. And if he wants to monologue for the next 5 minutes, we all have to sit and pretend like what he has to say is the most important thing. So you add these two dimensions, but the courtroom, the military aspect, and you can just, it's just the perfect environment for Sorkin to do his thing. And he's one of these guys where once he writes it down, he really wants the actors to say the exact things. Like he will give notes. You know, he was sort of famous on the West Wing set for saying, "Okay, yes, but you missed the and there," or "you there was supposed to be a pause in between that word and that word." So with a lot of, you know, a lot of actors can just kind of riff. Sorkin really wants his dialogue to be delivered exactly how he envisioned it. So this is sort of his perfect entree into the industry. And then on top of that, you add Jack.
Yeah.
You add Jack to that equation. And it's just a perfect confluence of this world building that Sorkin does through dialogue.
Right. And it is that. I mean, it is as dialogue-y a movie you'll find. This is certainly a tell, don't show approach to movie making, which is kind of fascinating, because if you were to watch this with the sound off, you're like, I guess nothing's happening.
Well, they're at the restaurant again.
Yeah. It's messy seafood.
Well,
it's not romance.
Yeah, but if...
like, there's no romance coming out of it.
Well, if you watch it with the sound off, you would look at Demi Moore's eyes and you'd be like, she just really wants that guy naked. Like, she goes from, like, just total contempt. Like, she just cannot even stand the thought that Tom Cruise exists. And then as soon as he takes the case, she's just making love to him with her eyeballs the rest of the movie. another Sorkin-y thing. I think that there was a sex scene in the movie that got cut out, but it's not really about the love story. It's sort of it's about something else. The love story isn't even like an F plot in this movie. It just kind of implied that the better he does in the courtroom, the more sexy he will be to her.
How snappy would that dirty talk have been in that sex scene, too?
Oh, man. I mean, so Demi Moore was up for this, and she got the part over against Jodie Foster, over against Linda Hamilton, because she was willing to work for less money.
Yeah.
But I kind of like her in this movie. It's one of these things where, it's called out from the beginning that she's not a great lawyer. She's got a lot of passion.
She's adept, but not, you don't want her, like, well, and it's interesting too, because it's like, is that how it's read? Or, I mean, like, I did read it that way a little bit, but I also,
like, there's that early scene where they're like, go get us some coffee. I don't want coffee. Would you leave the room so we could talk about you behind your back? She leaves, and then they say, like, well, she's all passion, but she's not the kind of person you want on the lead of a thing like this.
Right. But I was having a different read maybe a little bit on this. I couldn't quite tell. First off, I think there was a misogynistic factor for sure. And then I think secondly, the whole point of getting Cruz or Kathy in this situation is because they don't want this to go to
That's
trial.
A really crucial part of this movie, right?
And her passion would be detrimental to what their end goal is. Their end goal is to just settle this and move on. And putting her in the lead, I don't know if it was so much passion or if it was maybe she is good and maybe she is thorough. Maybe she doesn't have all of the what they call like the street smarts of lawyering, but she might, you know, and she does demonstrate a few times that she does, her passion kind of gets in the way a little bit in the courtroom, but also her passion is valuable to the team because it was going to go the path of just settle this and move on.
Okay, here's I was going to say this earlier. I think Bacon's the only good lawyer in this entire film. Like, Bacon seems to be playing by the rules. He knows the rules. He plays by them pretty well. He's believably a good lawyer.
And so much so that, like, when he sees that, like, okay, more stuff's coming out, like he understands the task at hand, and so he's like, all right, I'll bring this down. I will give you a sweetheart deal for your clients, because that is still worth it to not go this other step.
Yeah, the rest of these lawyers all have this fatal flaw. It's like, Caffey's all about the plea bargain, right? He's not going to take anything seriously because he feels like this is all kind of a game, and I've gotten pretty good at winning this game. It was a little, we were talking about Street Fighter 2, it was a little bit about me with E Honda. It's like, once I figure out how to do the 1,000 hand slap, why do I need to know how to do anything else?
Yeah.
So
so your entire mission is not to necessarily know how I'm playing or what somebody else is doing or what the other people's moves are. It's like, I just need to manipulate this thing to where I get in the get him in the corner.
Yeah, I found a little cheat code, and once I figured out my cheat code, I'm just going to do this over and over again. Of course, Cruz has never been in a courtroom, so that's his fatal flaw. And then she's all heart, right? I think she's sort of written as sort of the typical heart over head female in one of these movies. And then Kevin Pollak, he does nothing. He's happy about doing nothing. He kind of is a little bit put out that he has to go and observe people, other people working while he does nothing. And
yeah, he wants to do nothing, but he also wants to not do nothing more.
He's got a newborn child at home, and he just wants to dote over his new daughter. So Bacon's the only one that is actually taking his job seriously for the entire movie. At one point, Caffey decides that he's going to take the case. And the reason why he decides he's going to take the case is he realizes, why would they put me, who has never been in a courtroom, on a case of such importance? The only reason why Division would appoint me to this is because they want it to be settled out of court. And that pricks my masculinity a little bit, right? It's like, I'm predictably a used car salesman. And that's, you've insulted my honor as a lawyer, right? So right. That's the way he gets in, because of hubris.
And he doesn't even really have, it's not even a matter of like, yeah, because I have honor. It's just like, well, you don't think I have honor, so I'll muster some honor.
Or it's not like, okay, you guys are breaking the law, or hey, you guys are abusing my client, or you guys, you know, he gets in it because of hubris. Right. And then once he's in, his big strategy is he's going to prick the hubris of Jessup. He's going to say, he acknowledges, I have no case against this guy unless I can get him to be so arrogant on the stand that he just can't help himself but confess because he's that self-righteous. That's his whole strategy.
Right.
That's his whole strategy.
Well, and it almost is like finding that, I bet you there's something we have in common, right?
Yep.
Like, I mean, I'll bully you into you know, using, I'll use your honor against you.
Right.
And to a certain degree, that's kind of how he gets to where he's at, right? And if he knows if he can do that, he's like, look, I'm here for the, because of this type of thing.
Right.
Because I don't want, I'm not coming into the courtroom to lose and lose big. That's why I stay right out of the courtroom. So if you're going to get me in there, I'm going all the way. And it's the same thing he's thinking here with Jessup. It's like, Jessup's not going to come in here and just, like, one thing, he's not really going to lie. Right. I mean, like, and if you watch him, he's very careful. Like, and like the whole thing, when you get to even the terms, like with McKittrick, it's like, he's like, did you order the code red? And he's like, he can say, no, I did not, because I didn't call it a code red. I gave them a task. You know, I gave them an order.
But
I
didn't say.
Right. So I think that's interesting about the movie, is that there are those moments where you could insert, like, well, you know, McKittrick seems like he's a real, honorable guy, but here he is lying on the stand. It's like, not into the degree that he believes he is, or he you know, because everything is about, you know, technical verbiage.
This is one of those things where it's like, are you going to play the cards that were dealt to you, or are you going to play the man across the table? And what Cruz's character decides to do, he's like, look, I've got horrible cards. These cards suck. That guy with all the stripes on his arms, he's got all the cards. And everyone in that room is going to defer to him. And he's in the habit of being in those rooms, right? You know, for maybe the last 30 years of his life, he just got to monologue. He would got to boss people around. On the rare occasion that he, you know, he might be in the Oval Office, he might have to defer to someone else. And Caffey's thinking, I'm just going to play this guy. Because if he hates me. He hates me. And if I go in and I'm the most hateable that I can be, he's not going to be able to resist. He's going to want to take me down a notch. And he believes so fervently in the righteousness of his position that he doesn't even care if it's legal. And if he goes that way, I got him, right? So
right.
Cruz's character gets in the courtroom because of his own hubris. But once in the courtroom, he's able to play cat. He's able to play Jessup by pricking his hubris. And that's how he wins. It's kind of a goofy courtroom drama, right? It's sort of like,
right.
like I said, I don't know if anyone's that great of a lawyer, but Bacon in this room.
Yeah, it really is an interesting courtroom, like, because courtroom dramas are
kind of a Hail Mary at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
But it ends up working out. Courtroom
dramas
right?
are pretty important, right? I mean, they're typically, it feels like courtroom dramas are like they're just, they're dumbed down enough so that an audience can kind of keep up. But it feels like it's baked into enough legalese that we're learning something. This one feels like it's kind of a rudimentary court drama.
Well, it's okay. So that's right. And
but there's enough things that we're like, but it's paced so well and it really doesn't bog down. I mean, it really is. Like I said, it's a lot of dumbing down. It feels like, but it still works but it works almost. Again, this is where I think I go back to, like, it feels like a musical. Like, it just feels like the dialogue moves this along in such a way that, like a song would in a musical. Or something. Well, I guess we're singing now. And
yeah, it's almost like the rules of the courtroom are who can most convincingly, like, demonstrate their righteous indignation with an emotional speech, right? Who's going to win? Not the person with the law on their side. It's the person who delivers the most emotional speech. It works for this movie, and I don't know if it could work for any other movie. It's a little... It's kind of, like I said, it's a vehicle for Sorkin to have his monologues on display. I don't know if, like, I would be interested to talk to someone in the JAG Corps to figure out, like, where are all the problems with this movie? But right. Anyway, I enjoy it, even though I think probably a pretty janky courtroom drama.
When you talk about, like, Hail Marys, I mean, that is, everything feels that way, right? Because it's like, it could have easily just been like, nope, not going to happen. You know, I mean, obviously there's a requirement of this fiction that's in there because this guy's got a lot at stake. You know, I mean, he's about to get this heavy appointment and. But it really, the whole movie is basically suggesting the downfall of, or like the thing that makes these men supposedly so strong is their code, and ultimately, it's the thing that can bring them down. I mean, it's like their greatest strength is their greatest weakness.
So the other thing that is a little bit janky about this is the whole flight log thing. Like, if you were gonna explain to me why the flight logs are important, like there's no doubt that they're important. Right. Jessup doctored the flight logs. How does that connect with anything that's going on in the plot?
Yeah, the whole point being that, like, if well, I guess they're saying he had to wait, like they couldn't get him out right away, right? Like that's the premise, is that, well, there was an earlier flight, so they could have got him out sooner. It's like, but it doesn't. But what does that do for you? To your point, like, it, yeah, they could have transferred him immediately, but like that part of it is already established. It was not going to happen. So,
like, would it be so bad to say, like, yeah, we didn't send him out on the first flight. We had to do some paperwork, and we got him out on the second flight. Like, that's what? Why? Why is the truth?
Right.
Why not just say that?
Yeah. Like, why? Yeah, if they go, well, there was an earlier flight. It's like, yeah, for sure there was. But
yeah, where's your evidence? Like, what are you trying to insinuate here? I don't know. I don't know that. It's almost like the cover up is worse than the crime in this case.
Right, and ultimately, you need to have a cover up because you need him to be. You need something that Jessup did.
There needs to be a moment when Cruz communicates to Jack, you know that you did something wrong here, and I know that you did something wrong here, and now you know I know, and that's why Airman O'Malley and whoever else is in the back of the courtroom. Again, a total bluff. There's going to be no value if these guys testify.
Right. But Jessup is under the impression that if anything shows that something was altered, now there's another case, right? I mean,
it's a way to raise the stakes of the film and sort of heighten the emotion of the film. But if you really kind of boil it down to like, why is that important? It's like, clearly this doesn't help the plot along at all.
Right. Like, would it be better to prove that the transfer order was written after he was already
right passed, yeah, right? That would, I mean, be like, that would be a more
like,
effective,
like, if there was a way to do that, that's more in that seems more
well
damning,
and that's
right?
Why Markinson, you've got to have the whole Markinson suicide element, right you got to give a sense that this is winnable. If we could find this guy, if we get this guy to testify, this will be our smoking gun. And
all he has to do is say, no, this is what we're supposed to do.
That's right. And then, of course, he takes himself off the board. I guess that was a little note that William Goldman brought to the script. Did you know this part of it?
I did not.
So I'm a big fan of William Goldman. I've read a couple books that he wrote recently. He wrote Princess Bride. He wrote a lot, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Also wrote a great book about Hollywood and how to write screenplays. So he looks at the script by Sorkin and he makes a note and says, at the end, you should reveal that these guys were a total bluff, that they were actually not going to testify to the earlier flight. Because I guess what Sorkin did originally was, they were in the room because they actually did remember, and they were going to testify that they remember that there was an earlier flight that landed. And Goldman's little note was, it would be more satisfying at the end to know that Caffey had everything on the line because those guys were just there for a bluff. And that was his little note.
Yeah, and it truly does work. I mean, it is it adds so much to the Caffey character, and then it adds that, like, it keeps tension after it's already even been resolved, because then it causes you to go like, well, what would have happened if they had, you know? And it's like, well, it's fiction. There was no alternative, ending to this. This is how it is. But you get wrapped up into it, so it kind of keeps the tension alive even after the release valve has been set.
Yeah. I like it. And I like the way it ends. I like it. It ends right at the end of the trial. You don't even leave the courtroom. I think it's the same kind of camera shot they used in Inherit the Wind. And, the old timey script, the old timey font, the end.
Yeah. Which is interesting.
It's one of these things where it's like, no, that was it. What else are you going to be able to deliver that's going to make this movie better? Probably nothing. Let's end right here. That's the perfect ending.
How did you feel about the end part?
I like the ends. I kind of miss them. Yeah, do? It's a little nostalgia, a little bit nostalgia for me.
I mean, I just found myself really like musing over it after a while. Like, I'm like, why though? Like, it almost reads a little self-important. And there it is. It's all finished. It's like, yeah, I mean,
that's a Sorkinism. Like, self-importance is like fundamental to Sorkin's everything that Sorkin does.
But Rob Reiner doesn't have to do that.
That's true.
I mean, I think we should talk about Reiner too.
Okay, before we talk about Reiner, I want to talk about this font at the end, right? Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I saw a Marvel post-credit scene. It was like, oh, cool. I thought this was over, and it's not over. And that's gonna get me excited about the next film, right? Mm-hmm. That might have worked twice.
After a while, it gets old.
And then it was like, oh, come on, man. I just sat through a half an hour of commercials. I sat through your 3-hour movie. I sat through all of this, these CGI set pieces. Now I've got to sit through all of the credits to get to what might be a throwaway joke at the end.
Right.
That may or may not get me hyped up for the next movie. And even if I want to go home and just watch it on YouTube eventually, my kids are not going to want to leave the theater until they see this thing.
Right.
So I must have sat in 17 movie theaters a good 10 minutes longer than I should have. If I could have an old-timey cursive the end on all these Marvel movies,
giving you permission to go home.
Oh, I would take it in a heartbeat. I would take it in a heartbeat. I don't think people know how to end movies usually. But I thought this worked really well. I didn't mind the self-importance of it.
Yeah, I try to read it like I'm, you know, like this doesn't feel, because it's such a specific thing to do in movies that don't do it anymore. And the movie wasn't like, I don't know if it was, I started reading like, is this trying to put itself into sort of this pantheon of like, as far as it's concerned, this is a classic movie already, yes. You know? And I think that is what it's saying.
And it worked. I mean, it totally worked.
I also read it as a bookend of formality, because like this movie is very, very well structured in the way that like it spends a lot of time in the beginning, in the opening credits, watching how the synergy of Marines working
the
together
gun drills
in unison, yeah, and it's like such an important part of what this movie is going to be talking about, right? It's like, look at this precision. This precision does not come by accident. And there's a classicness to it. So that's why I saw that the end almost to me bookended, yep, like there's a classic quality to this. There's a formality to it. And it ended formally.
Okay. Regard. Let's talk about the beginning. So that first scene, you got the gun drills. This does a couple things for the film. In sort of economy of space, it establishes a world. These guys must have practiced for hours. And this ritual makes no sense in my life.
Right.
But in their world, it's important enough to practice over and over and over and over. And it's very performative. And they're wearing uniforms that, you know, it's like, it's not just military uniforms. It's dress uniform. So this is all about pomp and circumstance. This is a world wherein a devotion to this ritual makes sense.
And also, I think so it sets that up, but it also sets up, whether the viewer realizes it or not, say the things that you just said, which is like, this makes no sense to me. Why is this important? This almost seems, you know, contradictory to what I'm viewing. Like, you know, there's this mentality going throughout the film, especially from the Marines, which is like, we save lives, we protect lives, we protect lives. Uh-huh. Like, you know, the end justifies the means, because at the end of the day, you want me to protect you. I'm, you know, I'm a badass, and watch me do this little dance. It's a performance that is elevated in their minds, but at the same time, it's like, to what end? Could you have been spending any of that time when you were doing your choreography into just being?
You want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. And also, you like to watch me do gun tricks.
Exactly. You need me pirouetting. You need me plie. You can't handle my two-step.
I said, military gun drills are breakdancing for white guys.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. I like that.
It's like, you're using your body to kind of create an optical illusion, but for white guys, they need a rifle to make it happen.
That's right. They're popping, locking, and loading.
Popping, locking, and loading. Okay. All right. Let's talk about Reiner. Were you an All in the Family guy?
Like, it existed in my house.
I remember watching it and thinking, why is this on TV? Like,
Yeah, right. I mean, it was one of those things where, like, my family seemed to, like, have a reverence for uh-huh. it, right? And I, you know, most of it, I think, is just because my father was racist, and so was Archie Bunker. So it's like, he felt like he was finally getting representation on TV.
For all those years your dad wasn't around, you could at least pop on Archie Bunker.
Yeah, exactly. And they could say, well, this is what Dad thinks about what's going on right now. I knew that Rob Reiner's character was called a meathead. I think as a kid, that was like the only thing that really interested me.
Why is, like, his name
they'd meathead? They would be watching it, and then when Archie Bunker would call his son-in-law meathead, I'd go, well, that's funny. Like, that was it. Like, for me, it was like just a show where the word meathead's going to come by every once in a while.
So, yeah.
Underrated insult, by the way.
We should bring back meathead for sure.
Dude, meathead, I mean, it's pretty rough. I mean, just reducing your head, which houses your brain, into just meat.
Maybe the original nipple baby?
Maybe.
You know, Carl Reimer was kind of like comedy royalty.
Sure.
And here comes Rob. And then this is Spinal Tap. And it was kind of like, I mean, I think that there is something about someone who is known for being in a sitcom. It takes them a while for you to take them seriously on the big screen.
Especially then.
Like, especially when there was a huge gap between television stardom and film stardom.
Yeah, the thought was, this is the minor leagues.
Yeah.
And most people just go straight to the majors if they're going to be in the majors. And
right.
So it was such a big deal, like, when somebody would leave, like when Shelley Long leaves Cheers, it's like, whoa, this better work.
Or even when, like, Clooney leaves, you know, even then it was sort of like.
Well, because that's off. Wasn't that off the heels of David Caruso leaving NYPD Blue and then, like, just fading into.
Right.
Till he comes back to TV later. Right.
Right. So this was sort of before all that, when TV was kind of something that you might do on the back end of your career, right? It's like right. Mickey Rooney was tried to do a little television for a while. Didn't really work.
Was that Roomies with Dana yep. Carvey?
That's right. Now, was this a Spinal Tap? Was that his first film?
I believe so. I was just looking this up.
Because it's not like a throwaway comedy. It's sort of like, no, let's play with the form. It's very avant-garde.
Yeah, that was his directorial debut. It's
a pretty impressive directorial debut because, like, I don't know how much this was sort of influenced by Monty Python or something like that, but that's a pretty impressive debut. And then immediately it's like, oh, geez, I guess we should take Meathead seriously.
Right, because but then he directs The Sure Thing.
Not familiar with The Sure Thing.
With John Cusack.
Oh, I probably would enjoy this.
And it's, yeah, I don't know if it's, I never saw it, and I'd be curious because it is, I don't know if it's like a coming of age type thing or what, but yeah, so that's interesting. Like, so the year after he comes up with This is Spinal Tap, it's The Sure Thing. Next year, Stand By Me,
and establishes a little connection with Guest, right? Christopher Guest. Guest yes. is in This is Spinal Tap. Guest is in Princess Bride, small part. Guest is in A Few Good Men, small part.
Right.
Not
Stand By Me, he gets to work with Kiefer.
Kiefer's in Stand By Me for sure. So kind of known for, like, great sets, great to work with. Everyone likes to be on his in his crew. But in terms of themes, he's all over the place.
He really is, and it's hard to find. Like, I would almost, like, my initial thought was to sit there and say, well, thing with A Few Good Men, it's very enjoyable, it's sing-songy, it's all of these wonderful things, and it just feels like, but at the end of the day, it does no harm. And I feel like that's kind of a, and I was like, is that Rob Reiner? Is Rob Reiner the do no harm kind of, like just and this isn't to say that he's not good, because this is Spinal Tap is one of the best comedies I've ever seen.
And still holds up. I mean, really still holds up, right?
Stand By Me is infinitely watchable. It's very much of a time capsule. It's I don't know how well it ages, but it's kind of fine. You know, Princess Bride is considered, it's beloved, right? I mean, this thing is beloved. And but at the same time, if you watch it, you're like, it does no harm. When Harry Met Sally does no harm.
These are all feel-good movies. That's.
But what about Misery?
Well, Misery certainly. Misery is another, I guess, another collaboration with a Stephen King text. It was a very big deal when it came out.
Well, it's interesting, too, his career, like, right? So Spinal Tap's beloved, Sure Thing. I mean, it seemed like it. I think it did. I think it was received well. I just don't, you know, I don't have any relationship to it. Stand By Me, of course, feels classic. Princess Bride, classic. When Harry Met Sally is kind of an iconic romance film, right? Misery, A Few Good Men, and then he makes North, and North is considered one of the worst movies ever made.
Huh.
And then he makes The American President, which is, I think, pretty well received.
Another Sorkin collaboration.
The Ghosts of Mississippi, which, pretty bad reviews, like, not great. And then it just all seems to go downhill.
Well, there's a big element of this that you didn't mention. Right about the time of this film, he establishes Castle Rock Entertainment.
Mm.
And which, because of Seinfeld, makes billions of dollars, right? So he goes from sort of, you know, son of Carl Reiner to meathead to pretty well-regarded director to billionaire.
Mm.
And he's really on the money side of things after that. Maybe there's less of a drive to make an imprint on Hollywood once you have the FU money.
Right.
So all through the 2000s, he's just printing money, basically. And I think that that's kind of when it drops off for him.
Very, very political, minded activist. You do wonder if that does affect your drive. But all those movies that I had mentioned that are just sort of, they all kind of fall into the do no harm category.
Sure. Yeah.
And
aside so it's from interesting a light hobbling here and there, it's do no harm.
Right. A light hobbling, but you know, this, so A Few Good Men does feel like kind of peak Reiner, right? I mean, like there's, uh-huh. It's, I don't want to say that he fools me, but he helps lure you into a world that might feel better than it is.
Oh, and that's that, you know? And that is exactly a Sorkin thing too. It's like at the end of this movie, justice is done. In fact, justice is done so well that these guys who didn't order the code red, who were following orders, get dishonorably discharged. And because they are dishonorably discharged, it makes you feel like, no, that's right. They were not, you know, they were not completely innocent.
Kevin Pollak gets what he wants. Tom Cruise that's gets right. what he wants. Demi Moore gets what she
the
wants.
The courtroom levels everything. And even if you have political sway in the world, At the end of the day, it comes down to who is morally upright. Then justice is done, and everyone can feel like the world is an ordered place again.
Yeah, justice being the operative word, right? Like, hey, it has a cynical, it's a very cynical view on the military and military or militaristic hubris. But it's like, fear not. Even though we may rely on these people, they're still the judicial system, there is still justice to be served. And I don't know about you, do you feel, watching it now, that it feels like a crock of shit?
I think that that's maybe how we always should have felt. And again, this is one of those things where it's like, why do I go to the movies? Do I go to the movies because I want Tarantino to do... a realistic portrait of assassins in the world. No, no.
No.
I want him to entertain me. I want to see a story. You know, this movie makes you think about like a syrupy emotion between a son and his dead father. That's sort of the heart of the movie. In the same way that Moneyball is sort of like, all the math is kind of secondary to, can this guy stay in Oakland to be with his daughter? That's the stuff of movies. And so when I'm in this movie,
because even when we look back, we go, is Billy Bean a dummy?
Right. So when I look at this movie,
baseball genius, real life dummy.
When I'm in this movie, I almost don't care that these guys are bad lawyers. And I don't care that it's not realistic that a guy with that amount of political cachet is going to be arrested. This is a fantastic movie. And it's made in a way, in a discernible form, that's going to make me feel in a familiar way. And at the end of the day, I feel great at the end of this movie. And Reiner is the best at doing that.
Creating judicial Spider-Man.
Sure.
Like, why not?
That's exactly it. No, after this, you know, basically, Cruise decides to do a bunch of action films. And so he kind of feels like a super, you know, he's a superhero in everything but name after this. This is kind of, yeah, like you said, this is a legal Spider-Man kind of character.
Yeah.
Reiner's the best at this. And it's unfortunate that he became a billionaire, because I would have liked to see another 10 movies just like this. And I know that they're fantasy, and that's fine with
me. So that's a good question, though, too. Like, I haven't seen most of his later stuff that has kind of been mostly panned. And I wonder how much of it is that the movies are bad, or they're poorly directed, or their dialogue isn't good, or we are more cynical.
Oh, like maybe there's not room in the world for When Harry Met Sally anymore?
Like, all of those movies in 89 or 91 would have been considered better. Like, I'm just curious, right? Because it's like, there is something to be said for the growing cynicism and like the very fact that I'm looking at the end and I'm wondering, like, well, what's that all about? You know, like, what's your, you know, like get over yourself. And it's like, I've seen this movie, you know, probably half a dozen times, if not more, and I've never had a problem with the fact that it said the end before now. And I've always been cynic, but I'm not to the degree that I am now.
Okay, so yeah. So I'm a little bit cynical too. More cynical than I used to be, for sure. But I like to escape every now and again with a movie like this. And it's not just movies like this. Like, I will watch a movie that I like over and over and over because there are sort of familiar beats. And I know what's coming around the corner. It's sort of like comfort food.
Right.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has become that for me. Like, sometimes when I just want to sink myself into a world, I'll just put that on and watch 20 minutes of it. I won't necessarily watch the entire thing. I don't necessarily feel that way about this movie. But if I walked in halfway through this movie, I'd probably sit down and watch the rest of the movie. Because, you know it's ramping up to that Jack speech. And you know how you're going to feel at the end of that Jack speech.
Right. And because you think, I mean, it's like, because there's this big speech, and then it's like, aha, all that you just said became your undoing. And you get so caught up into that, right? I mean, it's true. You do get caught up into it in a way that I think, like, probably people who would like The Natural would get caught up into that scene. Where, you know, if The Natural wasn't such a god awful movie, like, I could see myself perhaps falling into that.
That movie is, I can't revisit that movie. This movie, I'm happy to revisit.
No,
I think
for sure.
Yeah, no, this is fantasy. It pushes the right emotional buttons. It makes us feel like, you know, it's very a team oriented movie.
It's Navy porn.
It's a little bit like that. It's a little bit like
it's in a way. It's almost like watching an NBA All-Star game. I know there's not a lot of defense, But man, look at the athleticism. You know, like I'm watching, you know, because I feel like Cruise does a really good job in this movie. And I know we've talked about Cruise a bit with Cocktail, but like with the dialogue, he delivers it. He gives you exactly what you need in this type of role. And again, it's no harm. He's doing no harm.
Well, at one point he calls to me more galactically stupid.
He told Kendrick to order the code red.
He did?
That's great. Why didn't you say so? And of course, you have proof of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting. You were sick the day they taught law at law school.
You put him on the stand and you get it from him.
Oh, we get it from him. Yes, no problem. We get it from him. Colonel Jessup, isn't it true that you ordered the code red on Santiago?
Listen, we're all a little...
I'm sorry. Your time's run out. What do we have for the losers, Judge? Well, for our defendants, it's a lifetime at exotic Fort Leavenworth. And for defense counsel Kathy, that's right, it's a court-martial! Yes, Johnny! After falsely accusing a highly decorated Marine officer of conspiracy and perjury, Lieutenant Kathy will have a long and prosperous career teaching typewriter maintenance at the Rocco Colombo School for Women. Thank you for playing. Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
That could hurt someone's feelings.
Right. Well, sure. That sure can. I guess that can harm their feelings. But the idea that this is how they're talking is, it's funny because you talk about how you don't like movies like Moonrise Kingdom because you don't like to see children given adult speech patterns and an adult way of speaking. And I'm like, that's not that different than watching Tom Cruise deliver Sorkin material.
Yeah, I don't know why that... Tarantino is similar in that way. Like, if you go to Kill Bill, there's going to be a lot of monologues. And they're going to be well-rehearsed. Or Pulp Fiction, you know. These gangsters are talking like philosophers. Everything is sort of like almost performed with perfection in the same way that the gun drill is performed to perfection.
Totally.
That speech had no ums. It had no stutters. It had no false starts. It was...
Every word was perfectly
yes,
placed.
Yes, it was a virtuoso performance. And that's not how people talk in real life. But... in a movie, you know, if the music's just right and, you know, you've set up the stakes just so, you know, it can feel like almost an action movie. You know, it can feel like right. that speech could feel every bit as satisfying as some giant set piece in an action movie.
As the fight scene in They Live.
I thought more about Tom Cruise after watching this. I think I've nailed down my opinion about Tom Cruise. I think at some point in his life he just got too weird to act.
So the same way that Rob Reiner got too rich to direct.
Yes. Yes.
Tom Cruise got too weird to act.
Yeah, I think so. I feel like early Tom Cruise was kind of hit or miss. That's fine. You know, you're always kind of going to get a version of Tom Cruise, but it's very watchable.
Tom Cruise is a movie star.
But he doesn't just become a movie star. He becomes kind of like something that's not human. Like if you were to find out that the Tom Cruise we've been watching for the last 20 years was like half machine, would you be surprised?
No, not at all.
I mean,
if you told me that Tom Cruise never existed, I would be like, whoa.
In terms of like his inhuman physical regimen, his sort of cultish devotion to Scientology, his, you know, all these things that kind of make him kind of a weirdo. They have to affect the acting in some way.
Right, it almost seems like lack of self-awareness is his superpower.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, yeah. So when I'm watching him on screen, he's kind of this weird exotic bird. I'm like, wait, no, that's not, something's off here.
I'd like to just watch him brush his teeth. I feel like that's weird.
You think he brushes his teeth?
I just think he does something weird.
Yeah, no, there's got to be some weird method.
He just stares in the mirror at his teeth until they whiten.
So yeah, no, I feel like I've been hard on Tom Cruise, but I feel like he's definitely got stages of his career, and the later stages of Cruise's career are just weird. He's just a weird guy to watch.
He makes a lot of movies too, which is kind of interesting. Like, he's a guy that, like, sometimes the bigger the actor, the less they do, because, you know, they don't have to, and maybe the choices they make are like a bigger deals. You know, they cost so much that they're hard to get, and they're making really calculated choices. But like, it just seems like there's always a Tom Cruise movie.
Okay, I want to put him in conversation with Downey Jr. for a minute. Because I think that those two had a similar era, came up around the same time, both kind of like were fast talking, snarky,
the cocky guy.
Cocky guys, right? Tom Cruise goes super pure, right? He gets into this cult where doesn't drink caffeine, doesn't eat sugar, sort of this weird space religion, basically, right? Weird.
He's a Jedi. He's a Jedi.
Okay. Yeah, weird space religion. Downey Jr. gets addicted to heroin. And so they both kind of go in these weird, the opposite directions. They were very similar actors that went in very, very different directions. They both wind up as very, very rich people by doing big set action movies in the end. Kind of two guys that started in a similar place, went diametrically opposite directions, and then wound up basically in the same spot.
Right. And they did have their period where, like, because like Few Good Men comes out at the same time, I think Chaplin
right.
comes out.
Yeah.
So you've got them now dipping their toe into, okay, this is the transition I'm going to make, right? I went from like kind of maybe cute, cocky, yeah. Not taken too seriously. Now I'm gonna dip my toe into Oscar level.
That's right.
Work, yeah. Right. And I'm, you know, they still, I mean, obviously Downey still does, but I mean, does Tom Cruise do any of that anymore?
I don't think he does.
Does he even, like, Downey Jr. will, right? I mean, Downey Jr., you know, has been nominated. Even in the midst of, you know, Avengers and all of that, right? But Tom Cruise, I don't think he's even, it doesn't even seem like he's interested in that at all.
Well, I mean, they're both franchise players, right? They're supposed to sort of top of the call list, franchise players. The difference is Tom Cruise never did a superhero movie. Like, never did a comic strip movie.
Right, which is interesting that he doesn't, right? I mean, because he's got franchises, like he has multiple franchises built around it.
So I almost wonder if Downey Jr. is like, no, I have, because I don't want to just be known as Iron Man. I need to do these other things to prove that I'm more than just a CGI star. Whereas Tom Cruise kind of went on this trajectory where it was like, no, I'm not really going to do things like A Few Good Men anymore. I'm gonna do this amazing stunt where I jump off a cliff face on a motorcycle.
Well, so Robert Downey Jr. plays a superhero. Tom Cruise became one.
Right, that's right. All right, Steve. Is there a trope, a cliche, or a device that you liked in this movie?
I mean, I am just give me almost anything in a courtroom, to be honest. I mean, like the
when he's sitting there at the end and you know, hands shaking, lips are sweaty, everyone's shaking him off, right? I mean, it's just like I know he's not gonna just say, okay, I'm done.
I like the very serious African American judge who's gonna give you a little bit of stank eye.
I'm quite certain I've earned it.
Just
I like when somebody threatens to piss in another person's dead skull.
I do believe I used that line when we were playing Risk once. That's how mad I was. I started quoting this movie.
Just start Jessica.
I love it when these lawyers like meet for drinks either before or after the big trial.
Oh yeah, those scenes. I just give me those.
I love that Kevin Bacon's kind of like, you know, what's his nickname is Smiling Jack Ross. You know, this guy's figured it out. You know, he's not going to get too invested. He's going to take his job seriously. He's going to wear a tank top that says Georgetown Supreme Court, but the O in court's going to have a basketball. And, you know, he's clearly on the Jag Corps softball team. I just think he's that's, you know, Bacon is just living the life in this movie.
Yeah, I was actually really impressed by his performance in this movie. I mean, I always consider Bacon very enjoyable and usually a pretty good actor. I thought he was really good in this, like really good.
Yeah, fantastic Bacon performance. All right, is there a tweak you would have made to this movie?
It's a good question because like it does so many things well. Mm-hmm. I think the tweak that I would have, I don't know that I wanted any level of romance between Demi Moore and Tom Cruise.
I don't want Tom Cruise to ever, I don't want to think about him sexually on any level.
That's fair. Because I feel like it undercuts the character a little bit because the whole, to me, her role is important because of how, you know, she's navigating this kind of male-dominated world, and I feel like that there was an opportunity to, and I thought they were doing more with her, but then I think to sort of almost put her in this maybe a little love interest type mm-hmm. thing in there, like, I'm like, that just undercuts her. Like, she didn't feel like that character was, like, she was passionate, but it was almost, well, she's passionate because she's a lady, right? You know, as opposed to, no, she's really good at this, and now she has an opportunity to do that in the male dominated world. You know what I mean? I felt like her character was necessary only in the sense that she was a plot device, and I felt that was a little up. There was opportunity there to make another.
Can you imagine Jodie Foster in this role?
Not really.
I think it would have been amazing. I think so? Jodie Foster would have been amazing.
Well, I just don't think in the way that, to me, it's not.
Oh,
the
you
way
would have had to was... rewrite. You'd have to rewrite it.
Right. So that's I think the, and so maybe that's the tweak, right? You bring somebody in who forces the issue to rewrite it.
Sure. Yeah.
Much in the same way that Tom Cruise was originally supposed to be, that the studio was pushing Tom Cruise on to Tim Burton for Edward Scissorhands, and he didn't want him. And Tom Cruise was like, yeah, he was interested, but he wanted it like rewrites. He wanted it to be more upbeat and the happier ending. And all
he wanted to turn it into Cocktail.
he's like, it's hard for me to flip all these spirit bottles with these scissors. Maybe we just get rid of the scissor hand. Maybe just call it Edward. Edward regular hand. Wouldn't that be fun?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I hated Downey. I hated Downey. Everything about Downey. Is this DC?
Yeah.
Hell? Are we in Washington, D.C., yeah. Hell?
Downey's pretty rough.
What did we do? We did nothing wrong, Hell.
Yeah. Downey's... They're both... I don't really like either of them, to be perfectly honest.
I guess... Yeah, no. Downey's... Jeez. Wish that that character would have been someone worth rooting for.
Right.
Yeah, I guess there's a big brother, little brother relationship happening there that...
Yeah,
it's important to the movie.
But we only see him as like, I'm like, is he simple?
He's simple.
You know, it's hard to
Isn't
know.
Isn't that it just?
That's the whole thing.
That's the whole thing. He's just simple. So, I guess originally in the original play, Tom Hulce plays Caffey.
Interesting.
So famous for his performance in Amadeus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then. Joshua Molina plays Downey. Joshua Molina is in this movie as the secretary to Jessup. When Jessup says, you know, I need you to call the president. We're going to surrender our forward area in Cuba.
Right.
And he just, yes, sir. He turns around. That was the original Downey.
Throw him a bit of a bone.
Then. I guess so. Steve, is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard movie?
This is the question, because I think we'll go back to, is Rob Reiner on par with a Ron Howard?
Period. I think that a lot of people, like if you were just going to list the movies between those two guys and ask, like, is this a Howard or a Reiner? It'd be tricky. It'd be really hard
to
figure out which is which.
Yeah, because my feeling is to say that this movie is properly Howard and in its best possible way.
Sure, sort of properly Howard in the Apollo 13 Howard.
Yes,
right?
Yes. That's kind
of
how I would
the common denominator, of course, is bacon.
It's always
so bacon. If you give Reiner bacon, he's going to be properly Howard. I'm going to say this is a Howard plus 3.
Okay. So you think Reiner achieved something that Howard?
So here's where I think it soars. I feel like the way that this movie ends is so memorable. I mean, the Jack speech at the end may be one of the best monologues in movie history. And delivered in the best possible way. So just the fact that it has that ending, like, can I find a Ron Howard film that has that kind of ending? I'm not sure. I think this might be a one of one.
Right. Yeah, I could see that because you were suggesting that Howard gives you an epilogue.
Right. Yeah. I guess. So you're going to say properly Howard. I'm going to say Howard plus 3. And this concludes our season of A Few Good Films. Did we learn anything about ourselves in this journey, Steve?
Well, I think we did. And I think this final episode of the season spoke to something that I think that we talked about early on, either in the podcast or off air. Was we didn't choose a Kevin Bacon movie. And kind of regrettably, and then here we are at the end going, wow, Kevin Bacon was amazing in this.
It's weird because in the moment, in the draft, we were realizing, wait, we haven't chosen a Bacon movie. And then we didn't correct ourselves.
No.
And now we're here. And I guess all we wanted to do was talk about Bacon.
I think that maybe that's because we were going to do the have a season of the degrees of Bacon where we would each draft a Bacon movie, I think we would flip a coin to figure out which one was watched first, and we would have to connect our way back to Bacon by picking an actor from one movie to the next and then try to see if we can work our
way. I'm not sure how the rules would work, but I'm wondering if we should commit at this point to just making the Bacon season happen.
Yeah, and so the question would be, do we keep it a degree to Bacon, where, again, there's only two Bacon movies, but you got to go from one to the other through the actors, and no Bacon in between. Or do we just always, all Bacon movies? That seems like a lot.
All right, how about this? We do a Bacon season with an indeterminate number of episodes.
To get our way back to Bacon.
So it could be a 6-episode season because we get back to Bacon on the 6th film. Or it could be a 20-episode season because that's how long it takes us to get back to Bacon.
3 episodes are just a draft.
I like to see how weird we could get this.
I like the idea. I might even do some mocks just to see what would happen. Like I said, the trick is we each pick a Bacon movie, right? That's where I think the key is. We pick it, and then we flip a coin to say which one goes first and which one's last, so we know where we're building. So if I say, I'm going to take Footloose, and then you say, well, I'm going to take Sleepers, then we flip to see which one is first, and if it's Footloose first, like, okay, we're going to build our way back to Sleepers through actors. So you kind of be thinking, like, who do I need? And we can't use the same actor. I mean, there could be some overlap. I mean, you can't pick the primary actor. You can't keep Lithgow in.
It'd be pretty funny if our Kevin Bacon season was all Lithgow.
All Lithgow. That's right.
All right, let's do it. Let's make it happen.
All right.
I don't know when we'll record all this, but that will be our next item. Steve, is there a Half the Battle, One to Grow On moment in A Few Good Men?
Yeah, don't put the bat in the closet.
I'm going to say do. Do put the bat in the closet. Okay.
Because it forces the issue.
It forces you to see the coats hung up on the rack. Yeah. And it will absolutely change your legal strategy.
Cocoon of horror.